Welcome back to the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, where we break down the health tech news every single week. And this week, I am joined by special guest, Dr. Luke, who is head of medical at Newman, as well as my colleagues, James, Hugh, and of course, producer Adma. Luke, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Jessica. Yeah, really great to be here. Had a busy week here at Newman, particularly around our weight loss offering, which has been in the news a lot this week, weight loss and the innovations there in terms of treatments. And yeah, and otherwise, busy week personally as well. Got a little toddler, and World Book Day was yesterday, so we were trying to create a costume for him. He ended up going as Evil P from Super Tato. Don't know if you guys know that book, but yeah, good fun.
Amazing. I'm actually a bit upset that we missed World Book Day here at Somex, and we really should have rocked up to our calls in our favourite book character costume. I'm not entirely sure who I would have chosen, but I feel like we really missed a trick there. Oh, definitely missed a content opportunity, that's for sure. James, Hugh, what's been going on in your week?
Yeah, busy week. Lots of client stuff, lots of just catching up after having quite a lot of fun at Het North last week. That was a great event. We'll be sharing a lot of clips and interviews from some of the great discussions we had there. Other than that, also prepping for Rewired next week. So excited to get stuck into the digital health community again next week.
Yeah, firmly into a little event season, aren't we? We had our Health Tech Podcast Live last week. So yeah, just recovering from that and getting the engines back going for business as usual. But yeah, it's nice. Loads of events going on, having to get lots of banners and all sorts of stuff printed. So our printing costs have gone through the roof, but I can deal with that because it's good exposure. So it's been a nice couple of weeks.
Good. And a busy few weeks with events coming up, as you say, Hugh. Back up to Birmingham, Manchester. The north of England is getting a lot of love from the Somex team at the moment. That's nice. Take it away from London. All right, well, without further ado, let's hop into our first story. And as Luke says, he's been very busy talking about obesity this week, particularly busy talking to the BMJ after they published an article, Let's Talk Differently About Obesity. Now, you submitted a response to that, a letter of response to the editor, which was published in the BMJ as well. So talk us through your response to this article from the BMJ and why an integrated approach to obesity, bringing together the benefits of digital technology with behavioural change, lifestyle support and medication, is really pivotal to tackling what we know is a really huge challenge globally and particularly in the Western world at the moment.
Yeah, so it was actually, you know, a very good article out in the BMJ talking about how you have to take a holistic picture with weight loss. But what I really wanted to stress in my response to them was that, there's a lot of news around these medications, the GLP-1 drugs or the new one, Mounjaro, which acts on both the receptors for GLP-1 hormone and GIP, and that these aren't a magic bullet treatment that you just take and then everything's fine. Yes, of course, if you take these medications, they will have their action. You'll have reduced appetite, reduced cravings, you'll probably lose some weight. But the worry is that you end up losing fat and muscle, and you need some lifestyle input in order to make sure you maintain or build muscle mass, because you don't want to be losing muscle and then reducing mobility, particularly in older age groups. That's a real indicator for poor health outcomes if they end up with reduced muscle mass and reduced mobility, a lot less resilience if they get anything like a trauma or an infection and ability to recover. So I think that it's really important to stress that there is no magic bullet solution. You still need to take the lifestyle measures, and that's how people get the best results. And we're talking about up to 20% weight loss over a 68-week period in the large trial that was done in Mounjaro, and it really is completely revolutionary and game-changing for people with obesity.
I think it's super interesting. And obviously, these medicines have not come without their controversy. And it's probably worth also saying that lots of that controversy has come from how those medicines have been used by people who are in the public eye in the US. And I think that obviously over here in the UK, you know, parameters around how we talk about prescription medicines and how people can access those kind of medications are very, very different. But I'm interested to kind of get your view on, you know, traditionally we talk about weight loss, you know, should be led by, you know, lifestyle change, diet, exercise, and that kind of thing. But, and that people are concerned that actually, as you just said, these kinds of medications can maybe be seen as a bit of a cheat code, that actually you can kind of skip those steps and go straight to the medication rather than actually putting in the graft, I guess. But who is it that these kinds of medications can really benefit? Because I think it's important to say that these aren't medications for everybody. These are medications to support certain people who are experiencing certain symptoms or living with certain health conditions. So how from a clinical perspective, do you identify who are the right people that can really benefit from these medications?
Yeah, so absolutely. I wouldn't recommend using these medications for short-term cosmetic gain. You know, someone wants to get a beach body, you hear about celebrities in Hollywood using it. Because we don't know, you know, you're messing with your biochemistry, and we don't know, you know, if you're yo-yoing on these medications, taking them for a few weeks, then off them, then taking them for a few weeks. What is this actually doing to the way your metabolism? And there's not enough evidence out there yet, so I would never recommend that. And of course, you know, in general, they're very safe drugs. Side effects are most common, are a bit of nausea, gastrointestinal type side effects, diarrhea. But in very rare cases, you get things like pancreatitis, gallstones, both of which can be very serious and even life-threatening, particularly in the case of pancreatitis. So it's not something to toy with, you know, putting yourself at a potential risk of serious side effects. So I wouldn't recommend it, say, for that cosmetic use. But I also think that organizations like NICE guidance for drugs like semaglutide is actually a little bit too conservative. It's probably a controversial thing to say, but they've recommended for quite obese people. So I think it was a BMI over 30 or 35 with a pre-existing condition. Now, of course, this drug is going to help those people massively, but we've got to think about moving from a reactive way of dealing with health to a more proactive way. It's something the NHS often talks about, but very rarely ever actually puts into play. And you've got to think these medications are going to be beneficial for people before they ever get a pre-existing weight-related condition. You want to try and prevent that ever happening. So you want to prevent diabetes, hypertension, you know, a stroke or a heart attack. And I think it's purely a resource-based decision, the cutoffs that NICE have put in place. And I think clinically we should be offering these treatments to people that are perhaps overweight before they become obese as a preventative measure. And that was supported in a big trial, SELECT trial, recently, which proved that taking semaglutide in people that are overweight or obese reduced the risk of cardiovascular events like heart attacks and strokes significantly. So I think we need to be taking a more preventative approach.
So is it fair to say then that there is a difference between, for example, you know, there at Newman you offer a, you know, weight management and weight loss service versus, you know, other providers online who perhaps are providing simply just the prescription versus like a full support service, and that there's something to be said for, I guess, bringing together that digital technology to enhance not only access to medications where maybe people are struggling to be able to get onto waiting lists or on waiting lists for a long time via the NHS, but also to make sure that they're being able to take the medications in the right way and are being monitored in the right way.
Yeah, I think it's really important to use digital technology not only to bring the treatment to people, so not only to increase the access, but also to increase the quality. I talk a lot in healthcare about meeting people's clinical needs, emotional needs, and practical needs. The clinical need is the diagnosis and the treatment, probably the bits that are the easiest that most healthcare organizations can do. But the emotional need around how does the person feel about their illness? How does it affect the way they behave? How does it affect their loved ones? And then the practical need, how do they get the advice that they trust in a format that they can understand on a channel that they want to receive it? And that's where it's on the emotional need and the practical need. where we can really improve the experience for people with the power of digital technology and the kind of service we're offering at Newbee.
So I really like where this sort of space is going with these types of medications. And again, possibly quite a controversial thing to say, but the detail probably isn't. I think, Luke, you'll probably appreciate this from a clinical point of view, that when these things first get talked about, there's always this vibe of like, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Anything that's like a miracle pill for something, it gives this kind of aura of like, I guess those like old school diet pills that just turned out to be like amphetamines or like, MDMA or whatever it was kind of like disguised as at the time. And you can be forgiven for kind of thinking that these, you know, miracle medications that come onto the market that help people with weight loss have got that kind of like golden or silver bullet nature to them. I like the fact that what we're now talking about is that it isn't that. I like the fact that there's now nuance. I like the fact that it's like, look, when you do use these prescribed by a clinician along with diet and exercise, it can give you that boost into then the formula or the formula that's then going to work for you that you can then keep going. It can be used as an adjunct to all these other things to help you along that journey, but it is still going to be you on the journey. It's still going to be required effort. I love that that nuance is coming in. And to your point around like, yeah, there are people that just chuck out the prescriptions versus there's what you're doing from a clinical perspective as a clinician yourself, which is like, hey, I'm going to prescribe this, but I'm going to do that in a clinic format where I'm also going to talk to you about the effect on your life, because that's how we make this thing work. I actually think that that narrative is giving these medications a lot more credibility. And actually, it makes people like me, who you'd hope is like slightly more informed than the general public, but like probably not too much anymore because I've been out of medicine for a few years now. But for people like me that are perhaps, you know, slightly cynical or not cynical, but maybe like worried about this mass use of this new medication and I guess worried about whatever those consequences would be, for people like me, it gives me a lot more hope. And actually, as I say, it gives the whole thing a lot more credibility for me of like, oh yeah, there are conditions in which this doesn't work so well. There are ways this doesn't work so well. But actually, when prescribed in the right way, in a clinic format, with all of the support that's more holistic, that's where we can get these things to work really well. So I like the way this is going, that the more we're talking about the nuance, the more it seems to, as I say, give it credibility and sort of almost prove that they do actually work.
Absolutely. And nuance is exactly that. It's the key. It's the key to all of healthcare, but I think particularly in relation to obesity, it's so personal. There's so much emotional attachment to people's, you know, the people have for their weight and what it means for them, that you really need to engage with someone and give them the kind of advice that actually resonates with them. There's no point in giving generic advice, you know, like go and run a 5K if somebody's got osteoarthritis in their knee. Somebody giving people dietary advice that isn't culturally relevant to them. That's another thing that I think that we've been often guilty of in mainstream healthcare and the NHS. And so you need to find what's right for the person. And then we're in a fortunate position where we are at Newman, where we can engage with someone whenever they want to engage. We're not bound by appointments. You message a coach on the app whenever you want to message the coach on the app. And we're fortunate that weight loss is unlikely to be anything particularly acute. And so we get back to people the next working day. And you have this ongoing dialogue. You really build that relationship and trust. If someone has a good relationship with their healthcare provider, they're much more likely to engage, follow the advice, and get the good outcome.
You're so right about healthcare being nuanced. And actually, one thing I actually noticed when I was training as a junior doctor was that at its best, primary care, there is a kind of beauty to primary care when in that more old school model of the doctor that knew the entire community, who knew those people, would then give their advice based on how much they know that person, i.e. if they're praying X times a day and aligning medication to that schedule, or quite to your point about cultural differences between diet and all those things. It seemed to me that even when I was on my rotations, that there were these kind of excellent like doctors that would take all of that into account. One thing that I actually learned when I was reading about all of this is the research behind the socioeconomic nature of individuals versus their ability to actually work these medications into a holistic treatment plan. Now, what I mean by that is, it's all well and good telling somebody to, like, oh, nip into the garden and do a few laps of your garden. That assumes they have a garden and it's big enough to do laps in. Like, oh, just make sure you cook some healthy food. That assumes they're on a good enough wage that allows them to make those good decisions, to actually make a decision at all, because they have enough time to go to a supermarket and go around. There's so many assumptions baked into all of that stuff. So you're absolutely right that requires that clinic environment, I think, to prescribe these medications properly, or else, you know, assuming a one size fits all for anything in healthcare is just playing with fire, let alone this, where it really requires understanding of the individual and helping them work it into an appropriate plan. Yeah, I think that's absolutely bang on what you just said.
And that one size fits all advice around weight loss that's been so common for decades, simply move more and eat less. It's just been proven by the efficacy of these medications not to be the right advice. You know, people have tried all kinds of diet and exercise plans, are not losing weight, are coming and spending a not insignificant amount of money when they come through to us at Newman in the, you know, it's in the hundreds of pounds a month. They really, you know, they're coming to this well-informed and having tried many things. And so, the fact that we've got something that's acting in another way, not just diet and exercise, acting on the hormonal pathway, just shows how multifactorial obesity is, along with genetics and along with more and more stuff coming out around the gut microbiome. So, yeah, just adding to that idea around nuance for people.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. That was the one thing that actually stuck out. Just my final point on this. The one thing that really stuck out for me in reading all of the research around this was that what every single paper, article, every bit of information seemingly that I came across all repeated the same thing, which is that the evidence says diet and exercise advice does not work at scale. It is not improving things. End of story. Other things are needed. Full stop. And it was just like everything I read was just that overwhelming advice, which, the whole weight loss clinic idea and these medications becoming a part of that just appreciates all that nuance. Really like that.
I may not be as sort of well-read around this subject as others, but we're still talking about diet and exercise mattering, though, clearly, right? Like, that does fit in with an integrated approach. These treatments are valuable for that. Some of the things like NICE has just recommended for behavior change on the NHS in the digital health space, also presumably quite useful tools for supporting weight loss, supporting, you know, a more holistic approach rather than just someone saying move more.
Yeah, so 100%. I can't stress enough about this point around needing to do resistance training to maintain muscle mass if you're on these medications. And of course, it plays a role. Of course, diet and exercise play a role. But what I'm trying to say is that they're not the solution, and they're not something to be used to blame patients for why they're obese or overweight. You don't diet, your diet's crap, and you don't move enough. Yes, of course, that's the case for some people. But, you know, there are plenty of people that have tried their best on diet and exercise and got very poor. And it just shows that that's not there are many other factors at play for obesity.
It's interesting what you said there, Hugh, about NICE as well, because I think they announced an early value assessment this week into digital technologies for delivering the multidisciplinary weight management service, which sounds a lot like what you're talking about there, Luke. And one of the things that they concluded was that actually there needs to be more evidence and research around the impact or the change, I guess, around weight adherence and completion rates and that kind of thing. But it also sounds quite optimistic from what I was reading around, you know, the potential for monitoring and even reporting on adverse events, which let's not forget with any medication is really important. And also better understanding the implications of bringing medication, lifestyle change and clinical support, what that looks like in terms of impact on health-related quality of life and psychological outcomes. I think, you know, that's super interesting that, you know, NICE are starting to look at some of these things around digital technologies. But I'm curious, Luke, from your point of view, anecdotally, what are you seeing at Newman around, you know, bringing together the technology with the clinical support?
Yeah, so it's around that better experience for people. So people can easily track their weight in our app and they don't have to go anywhere. You know, they don't have to go to any sort of bricks and mortar place to interact with us. They can message any time of the day or night. They don't have to book a traditional appointment, save up all their questions for that time slot and then walk away from that time slot with more questions and struggle to book another appointment. They can just message us anytime. And so you have this ongoing conversation. You build this relationship with people, this trust, similar to this, you know, this old adage of the rural GP. I often talk about that. You know, could we build that doctor-patient relationship with an entity like Newman? Could it be a Newman patient relationship where, you know, for the small number of conditions that we treat, you know, we are the experts in that area and patients fully trust us and people feel comfortable to be able to interact with us on whatever channel they prefer. You know, because we do telephone calls as well for people. They prefer that. But, you know, we find a majority of people prefer to email in or message us on the app.
Mm. Yeah, there's something super interesting about the benefit of that asynchronous communication with a healthcare professional. And I also wonder whether, and this is obviously on a case-by-case basis, but, like, you know, we know we're all really familiar with the challenges that the NHS is facing. And I think that can be incredibly off-putting to people seeking any kind of care, let alone care that is about something particularly sensitive. And I think that where there is a clinically led provider that has the trust and credibility and the credentials around safety, security and that kind of thing, that can actually be incredibly, I guess, interesting for people who maybe don't want to go to a traditional healthcare setting because they have anxiety around speaking to their GP or even being able to get an appointment for their GP. I wonder if there is something interesting there about the fact that, as you said, like being able to build that relationship with a patient and a clinician outside of the traditional NHS setting actually is seen as a real benefit to some people where there can be barriers for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, through cultural competence of the NHS or even accessibility. I think that's interesting, if not intriguing. Moving on to our second story of the day, which is serendipitous, really, because it's actually about Cree. And last week, I hosted a panel at the Health Tech X Summit with Socrates, who is founder and CEO at Newman, obviously, and also Kala, who is COO at Cree. And we were talking about telehealth. We're talking about the benefit of technology in better supporting people with their care. So, yeah, a little bit serendipitous that we're talking about this today. But the story is that Cree has announced that it is profitable in all markets. And interestingly, that has come down to its use of AI. And not just any AI, but it sounds like generative AI. Hugh, you have had a read of this one. What is happening and how have they achieved it?
So, yeah, I think this is a really exciting story for the whole generative AI in healthcare piece and a lot of what we've been talking about for months, if not almost years by this point. So Cree, which, anyone sort of familiar and who keeps up with digital health and health tech news, they had 8 years of losses in a row. And I think early last year announced that they were moving towards profitability and expecting it. They've just announced that in all three markets that they're operating in at the moment, so that's France, the UK and Sweden, they have reached profitability, which is, you know, fantastic news. Obviously, it's been a process to get there. They pulled out of Germany last year. There's been layoffs, and there are the struggles that any scale up is going to face when they're operating in multiple markets. But I think it's, you know, really fascinating to see that they've got there. Huge congratulations to the team for making it. But they are crediting generative AI and saying, focusing on the internal efficiency. The article says since the release of OpenAI's GPT 3.5, which is interesting given what a lot of people say about don't use 3.5 and make sure to be using 4. And also interesting in terms of what we've been talking about, you know, is it ChatGPT that will be, you know, used in healthcare? How is it being used? I think what's really interesting for me about this is they don't go into a lot of detail about where it's being deployed. There's definitely some impact on the relationship, on the clinician, on the admin that the clinician does that has meant they've been able to save time, that they've been able to save appointment time. But there's not, you know, they've not said it's explicitly this process they've changed, it's explicitly that process. So, you know, it sounds like there is element of clinical admin, element of, you know, internal operational admin within the business as well. So possibly more than just a healthcare challenge to be addressed with generative AI. You know, we could be looking at, you know, where can other businesses save operational efficiency? Where are there other opportunities? And I think I'd love to really, you know, have a chat with their team about how they've done this, because I think, you know, it's really exciting. But for me, this is interesting because obviously they're a scale up, they're a private business. And we talk a lot about how generative AI could help the NHS. And I wonder, you know, if we looked towards what's been achieved here, and actually any sort of real healthcare use has to be approved, has to be a medical device, has to be tested, has to be piloted. I wonder if there are opportunities elsewhere that we can look to for public health systems as much and save on some of the productivity challenges that we're facing across healthcare, not just in one business or one area. So, yeah, that's what's going on. Keen to get everyone's views on generative AI in health and where we think some of these savings might have come from.
Okay, there's a couple of things that are interesting for me on this. Obviously, of course, reaching profitability is great for a health tech company. Let's start there, because I think it's good aspirationally that we know it's possible. You can build a business in health tech and make it profitable. So there is that. Obviously, acknowledging layoffs to the tune of, you know, 400 people got laid off, pulled out of Germany, etc. But I think from what I remember speaking to Calla on my podcast actually, and businesses have to make tough decisions sometimes for the greater good, for the mission, for all the rest of it. Now, of course, on an individual level, it's painful and horrifying and all the rest of it for some of those individuals. Cree has a mission. It was to make healthcare more accessible via telemedicine, all these different means, and it's had to make tough decisions to do that. And so that is what it is. The interesting thing for me, well, there's two, actually. The first one is that operations in each country are profitable. On a group level, they're still in the red, and the article talks about that. And that's because what they're basically saying is we can now run our service profitably, but we are choosing to invest in things still to make our entire business better. That is essentially what they're saying. So what they are saying is that they are spending lots of money on heavy technology investments, they describe it. And that's because they have runway. And when you think about what they've done in going from country to country and setting things up and spending loads of money to do it, I think it is still great that they are investing in technology to make the whole thing better. They're not obsessing about profitability just because they've now become possibly profitable in every country. They're choosing not to at the group level to continue to make their business better and more efficient and, well, investing in technology to do so. So I think that's interesting. The other thing is that there's a sentence in this that says, even if Cree has opened up physical care centers, it is still very much a tech company. But with 4,000 employees and a company operating in primary care, AI's been able to cut our admin costs significantly. Now, I think this is interesting that a tech company in healthcare has become profitable with not just a tech business model. Those unit economics of pure technology and this promise of big VC investment, pure tech, huge gross margins, scale, 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 profitability at some point, and then massive, enormous exit. That isn't the story here. The story here is there are people in this business model. There are people in this loop. It is not pure tech and massive gross margin. This is physical care centers, bricks and mortar. This is humans as part of this stuff. They're paying clinicians to be on the other end of the telemedicine, etc. So this is not those ridiculous unit economics that we're all promised with digital therapeutics and all the rest of it. This is talking about an actual, very real healthcare business here that uses technology, but it is a healthcare business that has a service for people and by people. It just has technology making it efficient. And I think that's important. It's important because the type of investors that this attracts is more that kind of private equity type investments where you're not expecting the obscene multiples on your investment. You're accepting of lower multiples, but you're accepting of those lower multiples because it has people involved and because it's more sticky. It's slower growth, but it's a more robust business. And I think that is important to note here, that for people growing these types of businesses, be it a digital therapeutic, be it empty pipes where people are sat on the other end, it's okay to have people as part of that. It's okay to not be as profitable with your gross margins and things like that, because you, by accepting that people are in the loop and the unit economics is not looking so good as a SaaS business in healthcare, that is not only okay, that's actually important and necessary to run a business in healthcare. So when I read this, that's what I think. And I think that's what Cree have done quite well here in how they've grown it and how they've presented it and how they've eventually got to profitability utilizing a model that that includes human beings and physical care centers and all the rest of it. It's interesting and very good, I think, for people to see this, that is what is required. Healthcare is not a collection of products. It's a service. And actually, to run a good service, you need good people. And that's what the tech can sit in the middle of a lot of those human-to-human interactions. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
I think it's also all the more impressive, shall we say, that whilst, as you say, James, that, you know, they've clearly had to make difficult decisions on this road to profitability, but against the backdrop of the whole Babylon situation as well, where clearly, you know, they were prolific in what they were doing. It, you know, probably had quite different business models. The Babylon business model clearly didn't work. Cree have found a way to make it work in a way that I think lots of people question whether or not it would be possible with that type of business to be able to reach profitability and for it to be commercially viable. So I think that is interesting. And, you know, as I say, no mean feat against that backdrop and the current economy right now. But I guess, Luke, coming back to generative AI and how that can be used in how we better support people and reduce the burden on clinicians, you know, running a not necessarily similar business, but in the same kind of area where I guess you're engaging with patients on a digital basis, what's your view on where you think generative AI maybe could benefit clinicians and patients, but also I guess how efficiently businesses can scale and run?
Yeah, so of course, you know, I'm all for generative AI. It's clear to me the benefits it can have in that you know, for example, in our service that we run at Newman, we have a number of clinicians, mixture of pharmacists, nurses, doctors that are answering these messages from come in to our, via email, for example. Everyone is answered. You know, the common ones we've got, sometimes we've got common answers that we give. But yeah, everyone is answered individually. And that's obviously a big human cost to a business in terms of, you know, headcount and the number of people. And also, if you're sitting there and answering hundreds of messages and most of them are the same thing, it can get quite like monotonous as a person working. So could you use something like a generative AI to answer the common questions in a way that's empathetic, that feels real, that feels like a human, and actually use that human time to really engage with the patient more on a more human level? I think that would be fantastic because it would reduce costs for a business, but also improve that patient experience in terms of having real human interaction when a real human interaction is really required.
Nice. I actually think this is the perfect way to segue into our final story, where you've talked there about, like, you know, the monotony of repeating the same thing to lots of people who maybe have the same question or the answer is fundamentally the same. And I wonder if there's some kind of crossover, or I'm going to definitely make a crossover here, between generative AI and use of chatbots. Now, Pigeon this week really threw its eggs out of the nest. Hugh, why is Pigeon in a flap about chatbots?
So Pigeon's possibly slightly overreacted to this story very slightly, but I think it's a really good question as we start to look at generative AI and mental health and the use of chatbots and how valuable that they can be in addressing some of the mental health shortfalls, access to mental health support that is obviously currently an issue, not just in mental health, but in wider healthcare generally. So it's a great article that touches on, you know, the value of chatbots and what you actually want from a chatbot that's supporting with mental health. Do you want empathy? And I think the question is empathy versus actual support. And there's an interesting discussion that goes on in this article, which is the value of empathy versus the value of support. And, you know, in psychology and talking therapies, empathy isn't actually useful, which is very true. You don't want someone to go, oh dear. You want someone to help you and talk things through with you and get you to a conclusion.
I completely and utterly disagree with that. That empathy is not useful.
Empathy is not your end goal, though.
I think that, well, Luke, how about you and I talk about this? Empathy, right? Empathy versus the actual answer. So what is more valuable to a patient, the perfect diagnosis or the perfect consultation that made them feel good? When they leave the room, who's likely to get more complaints? Who's likely to, you know, which patient is likely to, I don't know, have a better outcome and all the rest of it. Now, on one hand, outcome, okay, might be, you know, perfect diagnosis, perfect treatment equals their problem resolved. If it is an acute problem that's reversible, okay, fine. But if you didn't conduct that with empathy, I don't know if it's more valuable or not that they felt better about the consultation and they went away happy versus whether they just had a problem solved and an interaction where they didn't feel cared for. And I think in my exploration of AI recently, I've had to really sort of question, like, what is it about being human and what is the human part of care? Like, what is feeling cared for? Like, what is all this? And is that more or less valuable? And I guess my conclusion on it is that actually the empathy is valuable and can be more valuable actually than the perfect diagnosis and treatment. You only have to look to palliative care for that actually, and oncology and all of those things. Now, yes, of course, the right treatment, the right chemotherapy for the right, like, yes, okay, that's going to have extreme value for extending that person's life or indeed curative or whatever, but the value of empathy and feeling cared for. That is that individual person's 100% experience of how they conduct their life and how they exist in their life and their body and their mind. The feeling of empathy can contribute to how they just feel 100% of their day, up to 100% of their day. And so to write that off against just extending their life or extending their healthy time, I want them to, there's no point extending their life or making them healthy if they're going to exist in a state of unhappiness. And that's what the empathy can serve to improve. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't know if Luke, you've got a thought on it, but I've not really articulated that well there, I don't think.
No, I think that I do agree with you, James, and sorry, Hugh, but it's definitely empathy is important. In terms of if somebody feels cared for, if someone feels that they trust the information, then they're much more likely to listen to the advice, adhere to treatment, feel motivated towards a good health outcome. And, you know, thinking about my general practice background, we often talk about how laying hands on a person is a way of building empathy, even though sometimes it's, you know, clinically not that valuable. For example, an abdominal examination isn't always valuable compared to an abdominal ultrasound or a CT. But the fact that you touch somebody and you said, look, I've checked you over thoroughly, and I actually think you need an ultrasound or a CT, you know, that builds that empathy. And then when we think about the context that we're talking about here around mental health and psychological treatment, so often I've seen patients who felt they didn't really gel with their therapist, didn't have a good relationship with their therapist. And that therapist may have been giving them absolutely the right advice, may have been giving them the solutions that they need. But if they didn't feel from the get-go that they could get over the barrier of the relationship with their therapist and having a good relationship with their therapist, then they're not going to get the benefit from the psychological intervention.
Consider pigeon put in this place. Which we absolutely are as well in this article by, you know, having questioned the sort of the role of chatbots in mental health, also celebrating the raise of Limbic, which has just picked up $14 million as part of its raise, and is in fact the first Class 2A certified medical device chatbot for mental health purposes. So I think that, you know, obviously we can discuss this. I think what we are seeing though is a clear division between the mental health chatbots that can be deployed and that have that clinical use validation, how they'll be used, and those which are more, I guess, empathetic, but not necessarily validated for a clinical purpose. So I'd be interested to see how that evolves as more and more companies come out of the gate on that.
I think this is awesome. I remember seeing Ross present Limbic a long time ago at one of the Capital Enterprise accelerators that they were part of. And it's been so interesting following Limbic since then and what Ross and the team have done, because in a time where chatbots, I guess, have come in and out of fashion, my read on it is that they've been very strong on their message the entire time, that this is clinical mental health AI, and they've just been incredibly consistent the entire time. And as I say, the word chatbot, almost from the investor point of view, has definitely fallen in and out of favor. But you're right, Hugh, it's the execution of it. And Limbic has always fallen on that clinical side and has always maintained that the way they're going about things has this clinical rigor to it. And I think that is what has essentially just kept them above the competition the whole time, and essentially has now got them to a point where, as leaders in the field, they're the ones that are now picking up this funding. Also interesting that Kozler Ventures have invested in it, because looking at the Kozler Ventures investments, they're putting together like a really interesting group of companies that are kind of synergistic. And you can see how if all of them were deployed in a single area, that clinical area would actually be a clinical area you might want to actually get treated in, or certainly practice medicine in. from our side of the table as well. So yeah, kudos to Limbic, and Coastal Ventures, one to watch with the way that that team are putting their portfolio together. I think it's really, really interesting.
You know, we talked about empathy and the importance of empathy, but I think a place where, you know, a very clinical type chatbot or AI could really help is where people need some kind of input, some kind of intervention, but the wait list is so long that by the time they get to see somebody, you know, they're more unwell or even not appropriate for that particular service they're referred to anymore in terms of their mental health. And so, you know, is there a place where, you know, the chatbot that maybe isn't as empathetic is still providing some value to somebody that needs some kind of psychological input on a waiting list? I think there's something there, particularly in the NHS context.
Yeah, definitely. I think digital has to be a big part of plugging that gap where people are being left desperate, you know, for mental health support and other support as well. That we have to find a way where that there are just not the people to be able to provide that support and service. I think I even saw the other day something about, might have been like ADHD support. And I appreciate it's not necessarily the same thing. And, you know, a chatbot perhaps wouldn't be appropriate in that context. But just to give, I guess, some perspective in terms of wait lists, I think they received a letter saying that they would hear within 2 years. Like the waiting list was going to be 2 years before they even heard from a specialist. And that must just be so demoralizing, particularly when you have a condition. I mean, all conditions affect your mental health, I believe, in some capacity. That's so demoralizing to hear when you're living with whatever it is that is going to be having an impact on your day-to-day life, that nothing changes for the better, at least for 2 years. And actually the reality is it's going to get worse. I think you're absolutely right that there's a real place for some kind of support system that is obviously validated and approved that can help people bridge that gap and hopefully prevent them from getting worse while they await the care that they need. Same with surgery and that kind of thing. Like there are people who wait for surgery and they get to the point actually where they're eligible for surgery, but actually they're physically, they're not in a position where they're able to have that, where actually if they'd had some kind of support, you know, through coaching or whatever it might have been, they may have been fit enough to be able to have that surgery. It's mind-boggling. I think, yeah, you make such a good point that there is such a place for this in the right place. Before we wrap up, I would just like to say that those noises that James made, I actually thought that was the dog when he was disagreeing with Hugh on empathy. I really believe that was Nuno's input into the podcast. Nuno is in fact sleeping, so it was not him. But really caught me off guard there. He really clearly got James in a moment. Anyway, moving on for that and wrapping
we'll
up.
We'll be having
today.
A podcast etiquette debriefing session afterwards.
Luke, thank you so much for joining us today. If people want to find out more about Newman and the kind of services that you provide and the help that they might be able to get, where can they find you?
The best place to find us is on our website, www.newman.com, N-U-M-A-N. Of course, you can always email our clinical team at clinic@newman.com with any questions you have about any of the services we offer.
Amazing. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us. It's been a real education, and we look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed the discussion. I've been a long-time subscriber, so it's a real privilege to be on, so thank you.
Well, welcome, and we will definitely be having you back. Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for tuning into the Health Tech Pigeon podcast for this week. We will be back next week with some more drama, some more health tech news, some amazing events to join, and hopefully some less strange noises from James when he decides to disagree with us. See you next week.